Hello, and welcome to the Weekly News Roundup, a podcast of the Daily News. My name is Ann Brennan, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Metro West Daily News and the Milford Daily News. On Fridays, we discuss stories that made headlines with the reporters who covered them. As we return from a few weeks' hiatus, we'll talk about a Framingham resident who urges city officials to fight noise pollution, erroneous utility bills that were sent to Franklin residents, a quick-thinking 73-year-old woman who thwarted a carjacking in Natick, and a West Nile virus was detected in mosquitoes in Ashland. Thursday was a big day on Beacon Hill for Senator Karen Spilka. The Ashland Democrat was elected Senate president. The gavel was passed from Senator Harriet Chandler of Worcester during a ceremony that included Attorney General Maura Healey and State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Joining us now is John Phelps, a multimedia journalist in the Metro West Daily Newsroom, who spoke with Senator Spilka as she was about to take on her new job. Good morning, John.
Hello. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I had the opportunity to talk to Karen in a pretty in-depth interview, kind of taking a look at her career as a politician and what she hopes for in the next couple years as Senate president.
What are some of the things that she hopes for?
It's funny. I asked her that question, and she said a lot of the things that the district that she's working on district wide are also statewide issues as well. Education, transportation. She's a strong advocate for fighting for children's rights and people with disabilities, and the list kind of goes on and on. Senior citizens, and it was almost too much to fit into the article.
Yes, she does have a more progressive stance, I think, politically. And some of that may come about because of her earlier career. You talked to her about how, you know, she started out actually as a social worker.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. She went to the Cornell University for Social Work, which is a publicly funded college of Cornell, and got a degree in social work. And she decided to kind of uproot her life and move here to Massachusetts. She got a job as a waitress in Brookline. She said the restaurant is long closed, and I couldn't quite pinpoint the name of it. And then she got a job at an alternative school as a social worker.
And she moved here from New Jersey, am I correct in that?
Yonkers, New York.
Okay. And you came from a middle-class home. Her father
yep.
was a construction worker, I believe.
Yeah, her father worked as a builder and ran his own business, which had its ups and downs as the economy went, changes. And then her mom stayed at home and took care of the four kids, one of whom had Down syndrome.
So she brings all of that with her. And you wrote about how, you know, she's working and moves out to Ashland with her husband and decides, I'm going to start giving back to the community.
Yeah, she started pretty small on the personnel board in Ashland, and then she ran for school committee, and then there was some things on the state level that bothered her. So when John Stefanini stepped down from his post as state rep, she decided to run for that in a special election and won that seat in 2001. And then 2005, she ran for full term on the Senate.
And has held this ever since, and made her way up the leadership ranks until she was serving as the Senate Ways and Means
Committee. Yeah, I can't remember. She had all these different chairmanships for different committees and on the environment and education and
I think she was the majority whip, if I'm not mistaken, in your story. So that would mean she would have to really be working with everybody in the body to see
that
who's
was
voting
under
for what.
Senate President Teresa Murray.
Yes.
So, she really worked her way up, and then the former Senate President appointed her as the Senate Ways and Means Chairwoman,
and that was Stanley Rosenberg, who this year had to step down because of issues surrounding his husband and whether his husband was sexually abusing and assaulting people working in and around the state house.
Yep. for this piece, it was more of a profile on Karen and, mm-hmm. and kind of the life she lives. So the life she lives. So I didn't really touch base on that a little. I'm sure more of that will come out in subsequent articles.
Well, I've talked to her about this because she, you know, obviously if she was a part of Stanley Rosenberg's leadership team, they were close. And I know for her that, you know, she came out pretty strongly when he did before or around the time he stepped down saying that, you know, you violated our trust. But clearly she was with him. And it looks too that she's going to continue Rosenberg's way of kind of spreading power around the Senate to different chairmen and not making it such a top-down organization.
Yeah. The term he used, I think, is shared leadership, and Karen told me that she doesn't really like that term, but she definitely wants to continue working collaboratively. And if a chair of a committee or a certain senator has an expertise in a certain area, she definitely wants to lean into that.
Right. Well, we'll see how it unfolds. So she does take the position now, but the session is about ready to. The official session is it will end at the end of July.
Yeah, I think there's about 5 days left or so.
Right, and then they'll resume again. They could meet an unofficial session, but the official session will resume in January.
Yeah, she's holding off on any appointments until the next formal session.
Okay. Well, I'm going to shift gears here, John. You had another story about Framingham Foodie Cafe moving from a brick and mortar restaurant to a trailer on wheels. What's that about?
So I wrote a story about the Foodie Cafe. It's kind of always had an interesting history. It opened in kind of more of an industrial area of the city. I think for context, it's kind of near the. It was near the Keefe Tech High School and the Loring Arena there, and they've kind of always had an interesting mission of helping other people, and somewhere along the lines, they founded a nonprofit called Daniel's Table, and then the Foodie Cafe became a way to kind of support that mission, and an opportunity opened up for them to park their food truck trailer. It's a 20-foot long trailer. It's pretty big, and they had an opportunity to park it in downtown Framingham. So they decided to shift the focus of their business a little for several reasons. They're running Daniel's Table out of a facility on Pearl Street, which is really close by, so they can kind of walk to it. And then they also kind of want to slow down and ease into retirement. So they thought it would be kind of a better way.
So they're down at the commuter rail station in downtown Framingham, Monday through Friday, serving breakfast and lunch.
Yes.
And Daniel's Table, can you explain a little bit about what that is? Because they're taking the money, I understand, from their Foodie Cafe to pay for meals for the hungry.
Yeah, everything that this family does is under the umbrella of Daniel's Table.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a program that they came up with, nonprofit, that helps to address the issue of hunger, specifically right now in Framingham. And their slogan used to be that they wanted to end hunger, but now it's to find more of a sustainable source of food for people.
Okay, well, John, thank you for joining us today and your insights. Look forward to having you again.
All right. Thanks for having me.
On Wednesday, we learned from John Featherson, who is chairman of the Board of Health in Ashland, that West Nile virus has been found in mosquitoes in that town, and health officials are asking people to take precautions. Featherston advises people ages 50 and older that they're at higher risk and so that they should protect themselves by wearing long sleeves and pants and applying insect repellent with DEET to lessen the chances of getting infected by these mosquitoes. They also ask that people, if you have anything with water, sitting water in your yards or anything, to try and to get rid of that and make sure you just reduce any type of sitting water around. If you want any more information, you can contact the Board of Health, or the link to the story we wrote will be with the show notes of this episode. So earlier this week, again, a resident in Framingham addressed the city council about noise pollution. With us now is Jim Hadadine, who can tell us more about this.
Hi, good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Jim.
Nice to be with you again.
As is for me, always.
Glad to hear that. So there's a resident in town who came to the city council with a very well-researched and very kind of thoroughly documented proposal to establish a new noise ordinance in Framingham. I guess city councilors have been hearing a lot of feedback from people who are kind of upset about noisy neighbors or kind of noise in the neighborhood. Coincidentally, somebody emailed me out of the blue like a week before this guy showed up at the city council meeting to say that I can't remember if it was her or him, but this person was very upset about motorcycles in the neighborhood and wondering, is there anything that can be done about it? So I guess Framingham doesn't have some kind of noise restrictions on the books in a formal bylaw or what would be now a city ordinance, and that has hampered police in enforcing noise issues, according to this resident who came to the city council. So he proposed a whole kind of set of different guidelines for how loud you could be at different times of the day and in different parts of the city. And that is going to be looked at now by a task force that the building commissioner is leading that's looking more broadly at nuisance bylaws in the city and kind of how to work that into a new city ordinance.
So this is probably all part of being a city where now you have these mechanisms in place where before these types of things fell through the cracks.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's something that you could have done as a town, but I think it is fair to say that, you know, this transition to a new form of government has kind of inspired people to look at things that they've wanted to fix for a while, and maybe this is an example of that, of just saying, okay, there's a new group of people that is taking a kind of a fresh look at a lot of different issues, and this might be a time to do it.
I was looking at the report by Stephen Ryder, I think. Is that how you say his name?
I believe so, yeah.
And he, like you said, it was well-researched. He had different decibel levels and, other very specific things that the city could do to looked at what was being done in other cities and towns. How seriously do you think the council's going to take this?
I kind of got the sense from the chairman of the council that, maybe he would have some hesitation about in whole adopting a noise ordinance, or at least not without getting, more opinions on the subject. But I think people are kind of serious about wanting to see something on the books. I will say a lot of the conversation that I've seen out there in the community since we published this article has been specifically around the idea of when you could use a snowblower. So part of the ordinance that I mentioned in the article would say, late in the evening, I think it's like after 10 p.m., mm-hmm. you couldn't pull a snowblower out and start clearing your property. And I think a lot of people looked at that specific part and said, oh, this is a terrible idea. I need to be able to clear my property after a snowstorm and I'm at work all day. And so I would be maybe surprised if that particular piece makes it into an ordinance, but it seems like there's support for people for doing something to put limits on how much noise you can make.
Right. That was one of the top most popular stories this week on our website, so it does seem to be of interest to people. Moving along, yesterday you were on hand when Framingham officials and residents said goodbye to longtime city clerk Valerie Mulvey.
Yeah, Valerie has been a pretty prominent figure in the town and now city for a number of years. And after 18 years, specifically as the city clerk or town clerk before that, but now the city clerk, she is preparing for her retirement on Friday and looking forward to more time with family and traveling and all the fun things that you get to do when you retire.
And during her career, she had some interesting positions. Like at one point, she was the interim town administrator, right?
Yeah, Valerie's kind of unique in that sense, as she's done so many different things in government. You know, Framingham has this kind of core group of people who really have been active for many, many years doing many things, a lot of them in town meeting or serving on committees and volunteering in different ways. And, even some of those people said, well, Valerie's really done it all. So she was born in Waltham, moved to Framingham in the mid-70s with her husband, Martin. And since then, she kind of started out very, very active in local politics before she became involved in government, then got a spot on the zoning board in the early 90s, the EDIC, the Economic Development Industrial Corporation, and eventually was elected to the Board of Selectmen for a few terms and then became the city clerk in 2000. And yeah, there were a couple of periods in the last 18 years when transitioned from one town manager to the next. The selectmen, you know, needed a steady hand to keep government going in between, and they looked to Valerie Mulvey to fill that role.
So what's next for this position?
Interestingly, Framingham also has an assistant town clerk and now city clerk, Lisa Ferguson, who has been there actually even longer than Valerie Mulvey. I guess she's been in the office since 1996. So people are very confident that she can take over and you know, keep the city clerk's office running just as well as it had been before. And you know, Lisa's been doing, she's served as the election clerk for the last several elections, so she's very well versed in that responsibility, which is a huge part of what the city clerk's office does. She apparently speaks Portuguese and Spanish too, so that seems like a huge asset for the community to have somebody in the city clerk's office who can interface with, you know, a wide variety of people who come in and need government services. So she has been tapped to serve as the, I think it's the acting city clerk, and this came up at the last city council meeting earlier this month, but because of notification requirements and job posting requirements, her kind of official designation in that role is going to take place in August, but it seems you know, all but a foregone conclusion that now she's going to be the new city clerk, and people seem very happy with her in that role.
And this is something that the mayor ultimately gets to choose, this position. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a position that is appointed by the mayor, and then there's, you know, an opportunity for the city council to provide consent or reject that nomination with a certain amount of votes. But I really get the sense that you're not going to see a lot of people who think it would be a bad idea to have Lisa Ferguson in that role.
Yeah. Interesting, because the whole charter that created the new city government, Mulvey was a huge presence on that, helping to create the new charter.
Yeah, and I think that really kind of speaks to what kind of an impact she had on town government and city government. So she was the last town clerk of Framingham and the first city clerk of Framingham. She worked on the Charter Commission and, you know, thought through these issues of what the new government was going to look like. And she's been there at all these town meetings for years and years, you know, helping town meeting get through all these different articles and sort through the background material. So it's hard to kind of understate, you know, overstate, what kind of role Valerie Mulvey's had in local government for a number of years.
Well, Jim, thank you for your reporting on these issues.
Yeah, thank you very much.
In Milford, demolition on two buildings that town officials said were dangerous began last week. Joining us now to talk about this is Allison Bozma, who's in our Milford Daily News office. Hello, Allison.
Hi, Ann.
So demolition has started, and what can you tell us about this project?
Sure. So I haven't had a chance to check in on it this week yet, but as of last week, they had taken down the majority of one of the two buildings they intend to demolish this round. Milford approved the purchase and demolition of three buildings on Central Street, but the third, which is 32 Central Street, they're right in a row on the same side of the street, that third one is going to remain under a lease. There's a furniture store owner who says he's storing things in there, wants to continue to do that for, it sounds like, another year.
And what was so dangerous about these buildings, or was it blight? What's behind this?
Sure. That reporting was done by my predecessor, Christopher Gavin, and it looked like in early June, the town engineer, Michael Dean, told selectmen that it was dangerous. It wasn't really clear why, but my impression is that they've been vacant for some time. They had to do some asbestos abatement before they did the demolition, so I don't know if it had anything to do with it.
Okay, and we'll watch this as this goes along. You had another story about three people who were accused of stealing $36,000 from a charity in Milford. What was that about?
Yep, so the three men who were arrested worked overnight at the Southern New England branch of Planet Aid. This is a place where the boxes, there's these big yellow boxes that say Planet Aid on them all over the place. You can put clothes in them or any kind of donations in them, and then trucks will go around, pick them up, and then bring them to the regional branches. So they brought them to this branch in Milford, and people like these three men would unload the trucks, inventory whatever was in them, put them away, process what was in the trucks, the donations. The accusation is that these three men, and police say this was caught on videotape, these three men unloaded the trucks, looked through the donations, took what they thought would, they thought was worth some money, and then put everything else away, then went back to what they had put away in the first place and put aside in the first place, packed it into their cars, drove away with it.
And there was suspicion on the part of the people who were running the Milford facility that things were going missing.
Sure, they noticed that. Yep.
And so maybe they were taking things that had already been set aside or whatever. Is that how they, do you know how they...
Planet A didn't get back to me. I called them and they didn't call me back. But they did suspect and then looked back over the video footage and told police that they, and then police confirmed that they saw these three men doing this every night.
And your article said that this could have been going on much longer than the tapes revealed.
We said potentially more than a year, but they'd only gone back for 2 weeks before they did the arrest.
Okay.
Made the arrest.
Well, Allison, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Sure, thank you.
Caitlin Kelleher, who produces the podcast, posted a ballot on our Milford Daily News website telling people to vote for who is the most famous Milfordian. What can you tell us about this, Caitlin?
I can tell you that so far, people have really seemed to respond to it, both in terms of voting and responses on our Facebook page. So this started out as a project between me and our intern, Caroline. I'd seen it, Fall River, do something similar a year ago with the most famous Fall River resident. They were marking the anniversary of Lizzie Borden's death, and I just thought, Borden's murders, her parents' deaths. And I just thought it would be something fun to try to do for one of our communities. And apparently I was right. And so we are right now doing the first of what will be 5 ballots. There are 8 residents in this one. There'll be 8 in each of the next 4, or the next 3, so 4 total. And the two semifinalists from each of those rounds will go on to be our final, and we will figure out who our most famous Milfordian is. I'm taking suggestions. If people want to add people to that list, they can email me at ckelleher@wickedlocal.com, which is ckelleher@wickedlocal.com, or they can find us on Facebook and our social media accounts. But it's really been a fun summer project that will take us into the fall a little bit.
So these are people that of historic figures?
There are some historic figures. We have a Nobel Prize winning doctor on the list. We have a family who is only one of 2 families in the country to have 3 generations play in the NFL. We have a current Major League Baseball player on this first ballot. So they really do run the gamut of people. And we wanted people, we didn't limit it to people who were just born in Milford or just graduated from Milford High. We looked at people who spent part of their life in Milford. And I know one of the more interesting pieces of this is a lot of our Facebook comments have been criticizing the fact that one of our selections, Howie Long, is in the ballot because they say he doesn't recognize Milford enough. So it'll be interesting to see where he comes out in that first round. We are in the first of 3 rounds of this first ballot, and so people can go on our website. is anchored under the carousel on our site, and people can vote for it. There's a rolling set of deadlines for each round.
Okay. And the carousel on our website is the prominent picture right
yes.
in the center.
Yes.
So you can look under that.
We use these terms all the time, and sometimes I forget. Most people don't always remember them as well.
Well, it's nice to have something fun on our website, because I think I'm hearing from a lot of people that they're totally stressed by the news cycle and what's going on around them, that's local, national, international. And so it's nice to have something that is a little more fun. And
at the beginning of next week, we will kick off NADIC.
Oh, okay.
And we are going to do sports figures first in NADIC. So if you live in a different community and you don't live in Milford and you want us to do one of these for your community, send me the suggestions as well, and we'll start compiling the ballots. I think my goal is to run one at a time so that I don't get totally confused.
Well, thank you, Caitlin.
You're welcome.
Wednesday night and Thursday morning, there was some pretty tough weather in the Upton area. The National Weather Service is looking into whether it might have been a tornado. Scott Causaleo from our Milford Daily News office has been out on the scene and joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hello.
So what'd you see out there?
Well, the most notable thing is one multifamily home had a roof, porch roof, that ended up on the other side of the house. Multiple knocked over trees, too many to count, branches and leaves everywhere over a couple residential areas and across Main Street.
And so the National Weather Service is trying to determine whether this was a microburst or a tornado. Is that correct?
Right. It's trying to determine whether it's a microburst or a tornado. And as I've learned recently, a microburst is more of a straight wind, while a tornado is obviously more of a swirling wind.
And did you talk to any of the people out there who live in the area that was stricken?
So I did. I spoke to one gentleman named Roberto Souza. He lives at 142 Main Street in that multifamily home I was talking about. And he actually lives exactly where the roof fell. And he described to me that, you know, he's used to some of the noise on Thursday mornings because of dumpster pickup. And he wasn't convinced that this level of noise was the dumpster being picked up. It was, in fact, the roof from the other side of the house banging straight into his wall. He said that he and the neighbors were outside in the rain, looking around in complete awe, trying to figure out what was going on. He said it was very scary. And I spoke to another woman who lives in one of the more rural places in town. It's a cul-de-sac, and she had a tree fall right into the back window of her car. It's covered by insurance, luckily for her, but, you know, inconvenience, couldn't make it to work today.
Yeah. Is there any indication that there were any injuries? Do you know?
From what I've gathered, no one was hurt. Everyone seems very safe, and there's a bit of good humor out there. Everyone's at work. From insurance people to the people with the chainsaws, they're all out there.
Okay, well, we'll look for your reports, updates on this in the weeks to come. You had another story this week about Franklin utility bills causing an error. I know as an editor, I got a couple of emails from Franklin residents asking, you know, what's going on. What did you find out about that?
So basically, it was simply a printing error. They had changed the template in which they print the bill on, and down at the bottom, the old rate had been displayed instead of the new rate, which was consequently higher. And though all the calculations on the bill were correct, like I said, they all added out to the lower rate. So that has now been addressed. The town apologizes. They didn't mean to make that error, and obviously people would have rather paid the lower rate.
Right. The town increased the rate, voted to increase the rate, or the town officials increased the rate by about 10% in January.
And yeah, that's true. They're working on a bunch of infrastructure changes that will really help improve basically the whole service and hopefully bring the price down in the near future.
And that's electric service you're talking about?
Water, sewer, trash.
Oh, okay. And another story that you covered about the Cristino family, who again are in Upton. They have a little bit of a past in Milford. They were forced out of their homes until repairs are made. This is an update. So can you update us on what's going on?
Yeah, so basically the house is in severe disrepair, and the Christina family haven't gotten their Title V inspection. They haven't gotten multiple different things done that need to be done in order for it to be considered a livable space.
And this is according to Upton officials, correct?
According to Upton officials, according to the town manager of Upton, Derek Brindisi. He was in court with them, I believe it was 2 weeks ago now. And it was ruled that they could no longer live in the house until the repairs are made. It's unclear where they'll be living. At the time, the Christinas had put a camper in their yard and said they wanted to live out of that, but the court also ruled that that wasn't an option.
Now, this is Mr. Christino has been getting a lot of notoriety when he was in Milford, and then now that he's in Upton, for the signs that he puts out in front of his property. At one point in Upton, he painted the entire fence with, I don't know how to explain it, but, you know, just giving his point of view sometimes,
right,
with pretty colorful language. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, so we know that he's had a history of expressing himself on outside of his property, on fences, on posters, or even when he was in Milford on the back of his truck once. But when it comes to this particular situation, he's directing his anger at the town government, specifically at one selectman who he believes was the former homeowner, Steve Matillion, though it's not confirmed that he was the former homeowner. His family was affiliated with the house, but it seems in a lot of ways his anger might be misdirected. But he's painting multiple profanities on his fence, and although his wife apologized in court, he has stated on Facebook multiple times that he is not sorry.
And when he was in Milford, he was actually accused of threatening the police chief with his signs, and I think Facebook posts, went to jail for, I think it was 2 years or at least a year before his case was acquitted, before the case was dismissed
He was
on constitutional grounds. Go ahead,
Scott. He was put away for stalking the police chief, but again, his entire case was dismissed, exonerated, and he was let out, and now he's being compensated by the state for his time in prison.
And there's no indication that the Upton police are going to take action against him for any reason.
No, not at the moment. The town government does now have authority that if he paints on his fence, to actually go on his property and paint back over it.
Okay.
But as long as he complies to what the court is asking, he shouldn't be facing any more jail time.
Okay. And just in terms of bringing the house up to code so that it's livable in the eyes of the Upton town officials, do you know what the family's plans are? I know that you tried to reach them many times, but had difficulty getting them to respond, or they didn't respond.
So from the last time I spoke with him on the first piece I wrote in Upton, he told me that he plans on fixing all these issues himself. He claims to have the knowledge to do so, though some of the issues do require actual engineers and permits and inspections, which he is seemingly not complying with.
Okay, well, Scott, we'll look forward to your continuing reports on this story. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
In Natick, a quick-thinking 73-year-old woman stifled an attempt to carjack her car and in the process saved a police officer perhaps from getting run over. Joining us now is Norman Miller, who covers crime and courts for the Metro West Daily News. Hello, Norm.
Hi, how are you?
So this sounded like a pretty interesting scene there.
Yeah, so what happened from the police report and talking to the Natick police, it was this woman, her name's Rochelle Oliveri, she's from Rhode Island. Her and two unknown accomplices were shoplifting at Lord & Taylor. when store security approached them, they took off running different directions. So security is chasing after this woman. And it happened to be a Natick police officer nearby, saw them running after, joined in the chase. She got all the way onto the street. She was on Speen Street. She tries to jump into one car. That driver sped away before she was able to jump in. And then she jumped into the backseat of another car, and she climbed over from the backseat onto the front seat and starts basically pushing and shoving the 73-year-old driver. And the officer, at first, you know, the car is right in front of him. He draws his weapon, and he's standing in front of the car. The woman, Rochelle Oliveri, allegedly slammed her foot down on the gas to try to run over the officer. The 73-year-old woman, right before it, slammed the car into park so the car didn't move. And then she was able to get the door unlocked, and the officers were able to drag the woman out, Oliveri out, and arrest her. The 73-year-old woman was uninjured. Police said she, you know, it was a difficult situation. You don't expect something like this, and she had the wherewithal to put the car in park and get the door unlocked while she's being physically assaulted. So, I mean, they said, like, even if she missed the officer, there were other people. Speen Street's a busy street. The car probably would have hit another car, or at least, or maybe the Lord and Taylor officer security guards are out there as well.
Wow, it's a wild scene. I'm not sure I could have kept my head about me enough to put a car in park.
Yeah, I know.
So what are the next steps of the charges in the case?
She's charged with carjacking, assault and battery on a person over 60, conspiracy, larceny, and resisting arrest, a couple other charges. She posted $2,000 bail and got released. She'll be back in court in September for a pretrial conference. If the carjacking charge sticks, if they don't dismiss it or charge it to another crime like attempted, the case will actually have to be indicted and moved to Superior Court because there's no final jurisdiction in district court. But it's always possible that they might lower the charge to attempted because she technically never got the car under her own control or anything like that. You have to wait and see about that.
Okay. Well, we'll look for your follow-up stories on that. Are they identifying the 73-year-old woman? I know we don't usually identify victims.
No, they impounded the woman's name because it was a stranger.
Okay.
A stranger crime. Because if this was a known person, they won't impound the name. But since it's a stranger, they don't want the actual suspect to be able to get her name and address and her friends. In general, not just this case, just to be able to harass or even threaten the alleged victims.
Okay. Well, there was another story that got a lot of traffic on our website. 8 men were busted in Marlboro in a prostitution sting.
Yes.
So what happened there?
Well, apparently the state police are doing this throughout the state. They're partnering with different local police departments, and they set up an online sting. They basically, I'm not sure what website they're using, they're not saying, because it used to be either Craigslist or Backpage, but Backpage is gone now, and Craigslist got rid of any personals, even got rid of like the massage therapist thing, because apparently that was being used for prostitution. So I don't know which website they're using, but they put an ad online and basically posed as a woman. And when they called, the undercover officer, either a state police or a Marlboro police officer, female officer would answer, and they'd, you know, talk. And once there was some kind of a monetary offer for sex was made, they arranged to meet him at a local hotel. Marlboro police didn't release the name of the hotel because the hotel actually volunteered the hotel room for him, and they don't want to get punished for it. And
right.
So they volunteered, but they'd set up, tell him which room to come, and when the men came to meet their dates for the next hour, they were greeted by officers who arrested him.
So is this part of an effort to kind of hit at human trafficking? Because I know there's a lot of human trafficking involved in prostitution.
Yeah. I think it's a twofold. I think a lot of hotels complain about things like that. And two, some of the human trafficking. And I think it's also just, I got an email after this from a resident. I didn't go to the website, but apparently there's a website that people who arrange to meet online hookers go, and they share information, and they'll like rate women and everything. But they also had a posting just about these busts, and the person sent me a clip, and it's basically all these people saying, well, now's another community we have to avoid. So from Marlboro's standpoint, this is great. They're avoiding our town because they don't know when and if it's going to be a prostitution bust. Right. Apparently, there's been others, and they're. I think it's just a random thing. I think they just want to do enforcement so it doesn't just run wild as well. Because if you don't do anything, why stop? It'll just grow.
Right.
So this puts it in people's mind, well, maybe we shouldn't do this because you don't know if it's going to be. And then they got men from all over the state. Mm-hmm. They got one man from Rhode Island arrested. They got one man from Missouri who was arrested. So.
Wow. Yeah, and it's interesting to see the shift towards the men who are trying to procure it as opposed to the women who are sex workers, for lack of a better.
I've noticed over the last few years, it seems like it's like alternating. Mm-hmm. Like when state police do like these type of busts, it seems like sometimes they'll pose as a woman. Other times they'll pose as a man. It's like almost like they go back and forth so they can get both sides of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think particularly when they, as a customer, that's when they would be more. I think that's more geared to human trafficking because you're actually finding the women. You're taking the women in custody. Yeah, you're arresting them. But this is probably the first time you're getting the exposure and be able to find out if they're being forced. Compared to this time, where there's no woman, it's just men who are taking advantage of. They're not, in their mind, they're not doing human trafficking because these are women who are volunteer.
Right.
So
right.
I think that's why they do both aspects of it.
Yeah. And I did see on our Facebook page when we posted this story, there were people who said this was entrapment, you know, like, so some question even this tactic.
Yeah. The only thing from I understand and from just from not this particular bus, but other bus, as long as the person who's being the one who's being arrested, either the woman or man, depending which side, mentions money first, it's not entrapment. It's if the officer is posing as a woman, like, hey, $300 for an hour of sex, that becomes entrapment. But if the man goes, well, I have $250, what will that get me? That's the money, and that gets rid of entrapment, at least under the eyes of the law.
Okay. Well, moving on to your other beat, all things beer.
Yep.
What's happening on the beer front?
Some interesting things in Metro West. I had a story this week. Barleycorn's Craft Brew in Natick. They've been open for 20 years, and they basically, it's a place where you go and brew your own beer. You go in, they have recipes already, or you can bring your own recipe. They have all the ingredients. They have all the tanks. They do all the cleanup. You brew the beer, leave for a few weeks, and come back and bottle it. Well, now they're actually adding a tap room to the business. So now you'll be able to go and actually they brew their own beer on site using their own ingredients. And then you can try. They'll have eight. They plan on having eight beers on tap and they're going to be selling bottles to go. And the actual tap room, they plan on opening the second weekend of September. But they currently, you can go there Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and they're pouring beers from bottles because they don't have the draft system hooked up. It's a great business idea because I've brewed beer there with friends over the years. And one thing, you're there for 3 or 4 hours brewing. You're all surrounded by everything beer and you can't have a beer. So now you like when you're there, you can have a couple beers. So it's almost 100% profit for the business. You maximize. You already have a trapped audience who are into beer. They'll buy the beer. They already have all the ingredients. They already have all the equipment. They have everything. So it's almost 100% profit for them. It adds, and it'll probably attract extra people. You know, people after work maybe want to stop because it's right downtown. Mm-hmm. Stop in for a beer on the way home or before or after they go to dinner.
Well, one of the interesting things is this was going to close down, right? A few months ago. And then they decided, well, maybe we're not. And is this where the tap room?
The original owner wanted to retire. Dan Ang, really good guy. But, you know, he was getting a little older. He wanted to spend more time with his grandchildren. He's originally from China, so he wants to go visit there a few times. So he was getting ready to close the business. Tom Wilbur and Fred Kelly, their brother-in-laws, they both like to brew, and they decided, well, why don't we move into this? Fred Kelly is a practicing lawyer, and I guess Tom Wilbur has a history of helping businesses start. So they moved in. They've been pushing like the corporate aspect of it, like bringing in like corporate groups to do collaborative brew so they can use all the tanks together, spend a few hours, get about, you know, 20, 25, maybe 30 people together, brew the beers, you know, kind of a corporate thing. And one thing they've noticed over the past years, every time they're doing these collaborative brews or when people are there, like, can we get a beer? and they weren't able to do it. So they approached the town. They got the farmer's brewer's license, which 95% of breweries in Massachusetts have. They got the federal permits, and then they got the town pouring permit. So now they'll be able to offer the beer. They're going to be open 3 days a week. They're open more than that, but they're only open the tap room Thursday, Fridays, and Saturdays. You'll be able to get a beer or two, and you still can brew beer. They're just basically rearranging things to try to maximize their space, so they'll still have all the same aspect as before, so that won't change, and this will just be an added bonus to it. So they have seating for 20 and 50 for capacity for the whole building. So it's going to be a small tap room. It's not going to be like a typical tap room. Like I said, their still number one thing is to be brewing your own beer there.
And if I wanted to go brew my own beer, not saying that I would, but
I think it'd be a great Metro West Daily News company outing.
What, so do you have to make an appointment or something, or can you just show up? How does that work?
It's better to make an appointment, I found, just because, especially on weekends, a lot of people go there. It's an interesting thing, because a lot of people, like myself, I don't brew, so I rely on them to have the recipe. But a lot of times home brewers will go there, because most home brewers brew their beer on a 5-gallon system. Their barrels, the minimums, you get 15 gallons, so you get 6 cases. So if you need more beer for a particular reason, like if you're bringing it to a party, a lot of times home brewers will go with their own recipes there. But it's better to probably make an appointment. And it does take some time, about 3 or 4 hours the first day brewing. You have to mill all your own grain, and you have to add all the additions at different types of parts of the boil at different temperatures. But then unlike other home brewing, you don't have to do the cleanup. You don't have to, you know, do like changing from one tank to another tank or dry hopping during the system. They do all that. Then you go back, depending how long, what type of beer it is, 2 to 4 weeks later, bottle the beer, which takes another 2 or 3 hours. Then you get up to 6 cases from each batch of beer you brew.
Okay. How much does it cost?
It's different depending on beer. I think like the low is like $110. And I think some of the like higher alcohol or things that have unusual ingredients will go up to maybe $200. But people think that might be a high price. But if you look at the styles of beer that are costing $200, 6 cases that would probably cost about $400. So you're getting a good bargain on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is there anything else you want to add about beer news?
Just one other thing. I was driving home from work one night. I was going through Hudson. And there's a new brewery opening in Hudson called Ground Effect Brewing. They have this sign up. I posted a photo on social media of it. It's looking good. I looked through the windows. It looks like it's coming along. From what I understand, is they're going to be pouring beer at the Spirit Hudson event in downtown Hudson on August 11th. So that might be the time they're debuting their first beers at that event. So that'd be another new brewery in Metro West. So
we keep getting more and more.
I know. Hudson will have Marlboro will have a few, and now Natick has two, and now Hudson will have two. So it keeps growing.
Yeah, fueling downtown renovation.
Yeah, the downtown renaissance.
Yes. Norm, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Weekly News Roundup. You can find links to the stories, photos, and video that we talked about on this episode, including photos of Senator Spilka's big day and video as well. Thank you to Caitlin Kelleher for her producing and editing this episode. You can find the podcast in the Apple Store, Google Play, or on our website, MetroWestDailyNews.com and MilfordDailyNews.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next week.